I'll tell you the good, and I'll tell you the bad. We're going to have a, what is this, TABC, no hoodie policy? Right, is that the scroll? TABC, is there, okay, why? Because just out of interest, what makes a hoodie so...
Or something. Like they never really explained it.
You look like a hood. That's called a hoodie? Because the hoodlum?
No. Because kids would walk around with their hoods up like this on their phones.
Oh, okay. That makes a lot of sense. No eye contact. No. Okay.
They probably just have a rule against like wearing your hood.
So they tried that and it didn't work, so they just banned hoodies altogether.
It's just like a comfortable
hoodie. Oh, you're not allowed to even come in like Ari, you couldn't come in dressed like that.
If the principal saw Ari, he would make you take that sweatshirt off.
Okay.
I mean, the same thing happened in Kohala. It was like not respecting the way.
Okay.
Back to
Meremar and Mozitra. Okay, Meremar and Mozitra probably wore hoods right, when it rained. Okay. This sugya is not brisket, at least the first part of the sugya that we're going to discuss today. Right? There's nothing in this Gemara that we're going to read today. We'll do a slight analysis. We'll see what the Rishonim say. But all of a sudden, build a new definition of something broader than the halacha. That's a quick layman's definition of lumbus. Everything we've seen until now, they're halachos, but they help us build definitions of categories that are broader than the halachos we're studying. So, for example, when the Mishnah says you have to build gvil v'gazis, that helped us better understand the mechayev of building a wall and possibly the overall system of tocha shcheinim. So we took a specific halacha, and it helped us understand categories that were far more important beyond just Baba Basra Daf Beis. Halacha Shcheinim and material. And yesterday, we described the specific halacha, how you de-shutifies, and that helped us understand the definition of shutfus that was global and that will help us in Nidarim or help us in Baba Metzia. That type of brisker alumnus, you don't really have here. You open up our Gemara, the Daf Gimel Amud Beis, you've got psychological, technical concerns why you can't dismantle a Beis HaKnesses. And we'll talk about them today. If we could create a perfect world, which is endless Batei Knesses, and people are diligent, and they don't waste any time, and projects get accomplished with the press of a button, then you could dismantle a shul easily. You've got other places to daven, no one's going to be negligent, you can be... So there's no... We don't have a better definition of the halachic identity of a shul, the halachic identity of construction, right, John? Maybe it'd be the Gemara that would tell us what a shul is, or what the definition of a Beit HaKnesset is, or what the definition of dismantle. I don't know, but there's nothing here. This is just need and response. Need means we have to prevent against derelict behavior. Response is don't dismantle the shul. This is a gzera to solve a human need. On the other hand, and listen carefully, this is a Gemara that talks to our hearts in a way that's much more direct than some of the previous Gemaras. Every piece of Torah should speak to your heart, because every piece of Torah is Hashem's will, and it's just an honor to be studying Hashem's will, and Hashem should be in the room. And beyond that, or in addition to that, at some level, everything about Shutfus and Shcheinim and Mechitzos creates a moral image, a moral snapshot that we should be able to build and understand what Hashem's sense of morality is, and what He wants of us, and privacy, and partnerships, and... But it's indirect, right? Let's face it. How many people have walked away over the last 2.5 weeks and said, oh my goodness, that shiur is going to dramatically change, fill in the blanks, my midos, my davening, my brachos. It's abstract. Now, obviously, the more abstract, the more structural, but the less direct. You're building a system. It's not going to directly affect Rafi Schlager today. But this thing is a little different. And that's why I want to spend a little time on this sugya. Okay, so please, everyone, listen carefully. Okay, it's really important. One of the major areas that gets short shrift in yeshivos in general, and it's really imperative, and we'll talk a lot about this, is how hard you'll work this year on tefillah. Now, it gets short shrift for many reasons. First of all, because it's non-reproducible. I can't reproduce my world of tefillah for you because it's emotional. I can reproduce my intellectual world for you because I can tell you how to analyze the sugya because that's more or less generic. We analyze math equations more or less the same way. We analyze Gemara more or less some difference of angles, but I can tell you this is A, this is B, this is C. I can't really share my personal emotions, but you have your own emotions. You've got your own relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You've got your own mindset, so I can't really. Second of all, tefillah, to a degree, is based on dependency and need, and you're at a stage, Baruch Hashem, because of your age and because of your socioeconomic positioning, where you don't really, how many of you have real burning need? You want to see people daven, go one day to a hospital and daven in a minyan in the hospital. Go spend a Shabbos in a hospital. You see people walking with oxygen tanks, people walking with IVs, people being rolled in on their beds, people literally on death's door coming and davening and really needing and sensing a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So it's hard because so much of davening is need and dependency. You're not at a stage where you're very dependent. And third of all, because in yeshivas classically, there's so much attention placed on learning and learning and learning and learning for good reasons, for proper reasons. That now, ironically, and please listen carefully, this is a really important introduction. I'm not going to talk that much about tefillah. That will do after Yom Tov. But ironically, it's your tefillah conditioning that's most long-lasting. Most of you in 20 years will not be learning the way you're learning this morning. I'd give my right arm if you could be learning at all, because it's so hard to learn in today's world. But my goal, and this is again a strange statement, and I'll help explain it to you later, if I knew that every one of you in 20 years would be learning an hour a day, dafyomi, I'd probably cut my right arm off right now. That'd be the trade. So that begs an interesting question. Well, if your goal is to get us to learn dafyomi in 20 years, why are you teaching us lamdas now? That's a legitimate question, and we'll talk about it. There are answers to that question. You could agree or disagree, but why would you just learn dafyomi all day? But most people, look around you. How many of you can identify people who learn? Don't raise your hands. How many of you can identify adults in your world, like more than 10, that actually learn regularly Gemara or more? Of those, how many learn lamdas? I imagine for some of you, the number to the first question is maybe 5 or 6. I mean non-rebbies, non-kol, professionals. And of those 5 and 6, how many learn lamdas? Most of us say 0, maybe 1. How many? So that's a legitimate question. But one of the anchors to your avodas Hashem is serious, serious davening. If I ask you, how many people do you know that are serious about their davening? How will we define that? We can define it different ways, and I will help you define it because there are many, many contours to it. The number goes sky high. People that are serious about minyan and serious about their davening, however you slice that, however you define serious about davening. So the irony is you're spending so much time on davening, on learning, and some boys just don't spend enough time thinking about davening, which is why I'm going to dedicate a month to helping you think about it. So take it seriously. And again, this is El also. We're not, as we say, pressuring anyone. We will, but davening in Yeshiva Minyan is not optional. It's not, if you want to, if you don't want to, whatever you want, davening in Yeshiva Minyan is part of the expectations and is mandatory. Now, in this type of yeshiva, how we treat mandatory obligations is a little bit different. We don't have clipboards and we don't throw you, but we will be helping you, after El in particular, find davening grooves. And if I see boys really falling off the grid in davening now, I'll try to help you. And I'll talk about yeshiva davening and Mirtz Hashem when the time comes, but trust me, there are at least 4, 5, or 6 reasons to be davening in the yeshiva minyan, even if it comes at the cost of extra learning at night or extra learning in the afternoon. You told me you have to take an hour nap in the afternoon every day as the price for davening in yeshiva minyan, that would be a no-brainer. Rav Aaron said that. I said that it's a no-brainer that you have to gain by coming to the yeshiva minyan. But this is not about yeshiva minyan today. I just want to put this on the table. And part of davening, okay? We'll get to all that in Mirtz Hashem as the year unfolds. But part of davening is kavana. And part of davening is encountering Hashem. And part of davening is praying for people. And part of davening is Jewish history. But part of davening is what we're going to discuss today. What role does the Beis HaKnesses play? What's the Beis HaKnesses in your life? Obviously, it's not just a place to daven. Some say, yes, let's leave. All you need is a place to daven. But we paskin, according to most shittos, the Ram paskin, to Mandi Amam Shirusa, that we're interested in shuls. We're interested in Batei Knesses. Okay? Now, just before we start diving into the Gemara, let me ask you a question just to help frame the conversation. Think of a person when I say the following profile. Who's the person that you most admire in their davening that you saw in your life? Oh, that person davens with a lot of kavana. Try to think of a person. Rebbe, a parent, a friend, a person in shul. Okay, now I'm going to ask a totally different question. They may overlap, they may not overlap. But who do you know in your life that is a shul guy? What do I mean by a shul guy? He always has the keys. He's the one everyone goes to. He has the keys to the kitchen. He's there last. He opens up the air when no one's there. He's the shul guy. Do you know what I'm talking about? The shul guy, the guy who like lives the shul, is in the shul, is always part. That's the shul guy. That's an important value also. You can't always have all, right? The shul guy. So shul, even if you don't have kavana, or even if the kavana is the same, right? The shul is important, not just because you want to have kavana. There's something about having a shul, we'll see today. So this sugi is not brisker. Put your brisker skills in your back pocket. There's very little brisk. Tomorrow's shiur will be a little more. Today we're not defining categories, but we are encountering how chazal, and keep in mind, this is really early shul history. In the first Beis HaMikdash, we certainly don't have records of shuls in Eretz Yisrael. Chazal talk about full of Batei Midrashas, Batei Knesios, but we don't have. Second Beis HaMikdash, we have more records, but it's pretty early in our shul's history. I mean, again, just to frame your conversation, has anyone ever visited a famous shul in the world, like a famous first shul in America, the largest shul in America, the biggest shul in Europe, the Altenai shul, the Budapest shul, the Newport shul, has anyone ever like been to shul? Anyone, maybe one day you want to take your kids on a shul hopping tour of all the top shuls in the world, top 10 shuls in the world, build a list. So let's learn about Batei Knesset through the eyes of Chazal, not necessarily building identities and categories, but how they saw it. Okay, so let's start the Gemara. Daf Gimel Amud Beis. I'm Rav Chisda, so we talked a lot about Rav Chisda. So this is our second encounter with Rav Chisda. Lo Lister Inish Beis Knishta, Adabani Beis Knishta Achrita. Okay, so you have to first build a new one, and then you can dismantle the old one, presumably for extra material or even for money, right? It costs $1 million to build a new shul. So we take out a loan, then we sell the old shul for $750,000. We pay off three-quarters of the loan. So you can dismantle or break or sell the land, but only after the second shul is standing. Okay? Why? Ikat ami mishum shiusa, ikat ami mishum tsluye, my benayu, at least according to our girsa, not the one in the parentheses. Whenever we have a parenthesis, we follow the other girsa. Ika, anyone know the girsa we have in our gemara, the girsa misar sashas? Ika? Duchta. Another place to daven. Ika duchta litzliye. Okay, another place that's quiet, I guess, that people can gather, that it's more or less weather appropriate. It's always a duchta. You can daven in a field, but it just means a legitimate house or shelter to daven in. Okay? So, who takes good, interesting English word? Who takes the most instrumental approach to the role of a Beis Knesset? So the Beis Knesset has no value other than facilitating tefillah. Pshiusa person or tzliya person? Tzliya. According to the tzliya person, as long as you have a place, Beis HaKnesses, non-Beis HaKnesses, doesn't make a difference. You just need a place. So in his world, at least according to our Girsa, in his world, Beis HaKnesses is just a tefillah facilitator. And if you have facilitation of tefillah without a Beis HaKnesses, no big deal. Whereas among the Amma Pshiusa, he's worried about long-term Beis HaKnesses. And possibly you'll be negligent if you don't build the second one first. Interesting that the Gemara seizes negligence. What does Rashi say? Anyone pick up in Rashi? Rashi introduces a different factor. Just how to read Rashi. There's no lumbus here. It's like, oh, this proves that. But Rashi, a different worry. Not that people will be derelict, but Benji?
Onus.
Right? You'll collect the money. Someone will steal it. They'll run out of building materials. Home Depot will close. A million different reasons, not Pshiusa. So why do we impose this strict limitation? You got to build one before you build the other. Because of human nature of negligence or just acts of nature, acts of God, acts of finance. The markets will collapse. You'll lose your money. So it's interesting that Rashi actually mentions both. Rashi says, Dilma Misrami Ones Upashri Vilobana. So there's a lot of conversation. Some Sofer talks about this, Rashi. Again, this is just working out the details psychologically, what we're really afraid of. Okay, so we're afraid that long term there won't be a shul, and even though you'll daven, you'll spend your whole life davening in the field or your whole life davening in the bedroom or think about this. Okay, think about this. Someone really cool. I saw this tweet last night. I really liked the tweet. I was thinking of Adiv last night and something. The tweet goes something like this: you ask an out of towner where they daven, you'll get a one word answer. You ask an in towner where they daven, you'll get a paragraph. Oh, Monday I daven here, and Tuesday I daven here, and Shabbos night I daven there, right? So there's something to be said about having a shul where you daven, and we'll talk about that as we talk about tefillah. So think about in some larger communities where people daven in living rooms, and people daven in basements, and people daven in places, as opposed to walking 10 minutes to shul. So if it saves you an hour and a half walk, of course, but if the 10-minute walk, shouldn't you be in a shul? Shouldn't you be in a basic Knesset? Now, it doesn't apply if you're davening for someone who's ill, can't make it to Beis HaKnesses, or you're davening in a hospital, or you're davening in an old age. There was a boy I accepted a couple of years ago to yeshiva from a high school that's well represented here. No, actually, not so represented. In high school, and I've got a couple of markers on my application, but if you hit one of those markers, you're in. Like, as far as there's some things that are more important than how well you eat Gemara. Sometimes I'll ask a boy, tell me about your family, sisters, brothers, goldfish, dogs, whatever. And then he'll say, and my grandfather lives with us. I say, well, where does your grandfather live? Well, he lives in my room. To me, that's an automatic end to the yeshiva. Because living with your grandfather and sharing a room and, of course, helping him and taking care of him and spending time with him, I imagine that creates character and tradition in the sense that more than 50 pages ago. That counts as 50 pages. You tell me, Rabbi, I learned 50 pages of Gemara for the Bechina. That would be, oh, you're in. So that to me is more than 50 pages of Gemara. So once I was interviewing a boy, he says that every Shabbos he walks to an old age home with his father. They've been making minyanim there for years. Like, what more do you need? That makes sense. That's right. That trains you. That trains you to be a good person, to be a caring person, to be a... And that's what I'm looking for, more than how many tosses in, you know. So, obviously, if you're making minyan, one of the hardest parts for me this past Shabbos was, all of a sudden, I daven mincha in yeshiva, because I had to give the shir. And then Marav time came, and for the last couple of years, I've been davening with my Rebbe, Rav Tabari Zichron Alevracha, who had ALS and was locked in and was trapped in a bed, and we made minyanim for him every... I couldn't make it during the week, I had to be here. I couldn't make it Shabbos morning, I had to be here, but I davened mincha Marav. It was really hard for me not to be with my Rebbe, who I haven't said a word to in 5 years, but I just felt his presence and felt like I was at least creating a minyan. So think about them. On the Yom Shusa, long-term there has to be Batei Knesses in town, long-term. So if it's short-term, someone who's sick, someone who's ill, someone, but long-term, all of a sudden a long-term disconnect from the Beis HaKnesses, at least according to this Monday Yomer. And by the way, who do we paskin like? Anyone get to that level? Do we paskin Pshusa or Tzliye? Who paskins Pshusa? The Rambam. Who paskins Tzliye? The Arzeruah. The Goas HaRash quotes the Arzeruah that I gave you. Namely, Joey, who paskins Pshusa, the Sephardi or the Ashkenazi? Who paskins, we don't pay that much attention to a Beis Knesses? The Ashkenazi. Arzeruah was, anyone know who the Arzeruah was? Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, who taught, anyone know? The Maharam Mirotenberg, who taught the Rush, who taught the Tour. Okay, so maybe we'll talk a little bit today about Ashkenazic Masara. That sounds like an oxymoron, because Ashkenazim were being so chaotic and disheveled and dispersed, they didn't have a strong sense of Masara. Sephardim would daven hundreds of years in the same Beit Knesset. You would be in a Beit Knesset where your great. Anyone have this? Of course not. I don't know, you're in a Beis HaKnesses of your great, seventh generation davening in that place. You're lucky if you're third generation davening in that place. So it's interesting. And the Rambam, the Sephardi, says Pshiusa. Whereas the Yitzchak of Vienna, the Ashkenazi, lived in Vienna. So for him, Beis HaKnesses was less central. Okay? Now, who takes the word Pshiusa and makes it even more stringent? We're not just worried about the Yom Pshiusa, about long-term Beis HaKnesses availability, but even more concerning. Who does this? Who switches it? Anyone? Nachum? What does the Rashba say? Pshiusa, everyone would be concerned with the long term, but no one's going to be that derelict. I'm explaining his implicit assumptions. They're going to get around to building, and at some point will be built. It's impossible to believe that people will be that negligent. But what are we really concerned with, Nachum? Not the lack of a Beis HaKnesses long term, but... Well, how does he change the word Pshusa? Not Pshusa if you won't build, but what word does he add? Pshusa? Shema? Anyone have the Rashba? I forgot to bring my Rashba today. Shema Yisrasho. The building will take too long. You'll build it eventually. The building will take too long, as it commonly does, right? It's natural. Most building projects, especially public works, where it's not a personal, there's no personal. I mean, how long do people, I'm sure anyone live in a community where the shul was built or rebuilt and it took, all these projects take too long. And for that duration, they won't have a shul to daven in. So according to the Rashba, Man Yama Pshiusa wasn't afraid that long-term there will never be a shul in Philadelphia. He was just concerned with 2 months without a shul, which is even more sensitive to the role of the shul. Imagine that. We can't dismantle a shul. The shul is old. It's not falling apart. That we call what? What does the Gemara call a shul that's falling apart? chaziba tiyua. If you see a structural crack, it's dangerous. You can't daven there. But the shul, we just want to renew the shul. We want to rebuild the shul. We want to make a nicer shul. Listen to this. You can't dismantle it for parts. And you can't dismantle it for money. And you can't dismantle it for land. And so you build a new shul. Why? Because what will happen to the people during those couple months? They won't have a shul to daven in. That's an amazing counterlogical comment. We're building a shul for the next 100 years, so people will just daven at home for a couple months. Man the Amar, who says Pshiyusa, according to the Rashba, says no. These are real concerns, guys. One day you'll be on the board of a shul, and you will decide to remodel the shul, rebuild the shul. Maybe you won't even disassemble it, but you'll just remodel it. And at that board meeting, someone will say, well, what's everyone going to do for the next 5 months or year? And someone will say, who cares? We're building a $70 million sparkling shul. Who cares what to do? So let them daven at home or something. They'll say, no. We have a responsibility to provide a shul. Maybe we'll borrow someone's shul, we'll rent the shul, put up a bubble with them. We have a responsibility to keep the shul going. First Gemara, again, I'm not posturing for you. There are always kulos and ways out, but value-wise, you don't. And what's the larger value here? That when you're working towards, listen carefully, it's really important, when you're working towards large-scale, overwhelming, surpassing goals, it doesn't give you the right to ignore small-scale needs. Some people justify, well, we're working on major, major, major projects here. If this thing slides a little of that, no. People that are thorough worry about large issues and small issues. They worry about years and they worry about days. What does this mean? We're building a shul for the next 50 years. So for 5 months, people, no, that's not. If values are values, then if they're long-term or short-term, now if one comes at the cost of the other, if you can only do one, but people that are thorough worry about everything. And you want to be thorough in morality, you want to be thorough in religion. Nothing.
How's that?
Duchta Litzli, according to him, means as long as I have a place to daven, not a basic nessus, a room, a field, an amphitheater, where the basic nessus is a building that can be designated. Duchta can mean I can use an office that's not being used now as opposed to a basic nessus. However, we find a basic nessus, but presumably designated solely for that purpose as a basic nessus. Okay? So the Rashba strengthens our concern with a basic nessus. Who strengthens it even more? What about that girsa? If your girsa is my benayo iki benayo, what girsa do we have in our Gemara? The ika, not duch dachrina, but ika beknish dachrina. This is the girsa of the Rabbeinu Yonah, and this is the girsa, some say, of the Rambam, because the Rambam paskins like the man of the Yamar Pshiusa, but he doesn't allow you to ever take down a base Knesset even. So if you hold that you need another base Knesset, what's the problem with that logically? Why is this gear so problematic logically? Okay, someone see if you can analyze. According to this gear, so what's the Nafkamina? Let's go through the reps. The Nafkamina, where the Mandiyamar Tzluye would allow you to dismantle, the Mandiyamar Pshusa would not allow you, is if you have another base Knesset. If you have another base Knesset, the Mandiyamar Tzluye, yes or no? Mandi Amar Pshiusa. No? What? You have another base at Knesset and you can't dismantle one? Why? What the heck does that mean? Beforehand, Nachum, we were talking about another place. Oh, we have another place, according to the Argirsa. Another place. So the Mandi Amar says you can't dismantle because place is not sufficient. We want a Beis HaKnesses, either long-term or even short-term, depending on how you read Pshiusa. So according to the Girsa that we have in the Masoras HaShas, the Girsa of the Bach, the scenario where they debated was you have a place but not a Beis HaKnesses. So one Mandi Amar says place is enough. The Pshiusa Mandi Amar says no, we want a Beis HaKnesses, either long-term or Akiva even short-term. But if they're not disagreeing when there's another place, listen to what I'm saying. Another place, Baruch, even the Mandi Amar Tzli won't agree. Place isn't enough. Everyone needs a Beis HaKnesses. And the only nafkamina is, not if there's a place, if there's another place which isn't a Beis HaKnesses, no one would sanction dismantling the first Beis HaKnesses. The only time that the Tzluya Mandiyama would sanction dismantling of Beis HaKnesses is if you have another Beis HaKnesses. So now we know why the Mandiyama Tzluya would sanction it. Why would the Mandiyama Pshiyus say, ban it? Why can't you dismantle a Beis HaKnesses if you have another Beis HaKnesses in town? What does this mean? That's why we reject the Girsa. But the Eliezer Ben Yonah has the Girsa. The Rambam, according to some, had the Girsa, because he paskins Pshiusa, Jacob, and he doesn't say if there's another place you can dismantle it. He doesn't say you can never dismantle it, because if we take this Girsa, you can never dismantle it. If another place, you can't dismantle it. If another basic Nessus, you can't dismantle it, according to Mandiyam Pshiusa. Why? What would you say, Benji?
Well, if we say that, which is apparently, this isn't an issue of just a place to have, but rather code basic Nessus, then it seems there's an issue with destroying and removing
Beis HaKnesses. Benji's saying that, yeah, sure it's not obvious. Benji's saying that we don't want to dismantle Bate Knesses. That there's some value to shuls, independent of their facilitation of tefillah and independent of how they affect our tefillah. As far as we're concerned, our tefillah will be unaffected. There's a beautiful, prettier shul down the block. It holds more people, better air conditioning, better rabbi, better kiddush, everything. But what does it mean to dismantle a shul? Even if it won't be used. Shuls are buildings, especially in Chutz La'aretz, where, as we'll talk about today, shuls, I don't just mean Chutz La'aretz, I mean after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, where shuls represent the closest we can come to building a Beis HaMikdash. I think a lot about Chutz La'aretz, where shuls were safe havens from the crazy, maddening world around you. When I walk out of shul, in Alon Shvut, I don't really feel like I'm passing a boundary. I live with Jews, and we gather a couple times a day to daven. Shul is beautiful in Alon Shvut. You have seen the shul yet in Alon Shvut? The new shul? Anyone go to the new shul? Beautiful building, beautiful shul. But when I'm in Chutz La'aretz, and I think about how many places Jews lived in that were hostile and violent and adversarial, and what the shul represented to them, and how people cared about the shul and built the shul, and these shuls speak to me. When I'm in England, so I go to shuls at 150 years old, 200 years old, something in America you don't really have. But it's a real joy for me to be in these places that Jews struggled historically to maintain their Judaism and to build their communities. And we don't want to take down a shul, even if we have 100 shuls in the community. Yaakov, what did you want to say?
We were talking about before. Why does it help? You're building another building. Like, how is the shul defined as the same shul?
I'm not sure. I don't understand your question. Lamandiyama Pshiusa?
Yeah, Lamandiyama
Pshiusa. You can never, according to this case, you can never dismantle a shul.
I'm saying,
until, what?
But if you're, let's say you're rebuilding the same shul. Right. Then there, it seems like, and you have the money.
No, because then you're keeping the number of shuls stable. So once I build the new shul, then I can take down the old shul, because there's never a time where the community has fewer shuls.
So the point is like the
gross number of shuls, right. At some point, we don't have unlimited resources. We can use the old shul to pay for the new shul, but only after we've maintained the amount of shuls in the landscape. Correct. Correct, yeah.
Gross number or identity of the synagogue?
Well, it's gross number, because you can, lo lister ad. It doesn't say lo lister, lo lister ad. Once you've built the new shul and you've reached the number, or the identity, or the replacement. Right. Nadav, let's get put on the air conditioning. 501, 501, because it's a little stuck in here, okay? What? You can switch seats if you want, Nadav, okay? So, this is a major. Did anyone see, before I answer your question, Benji, anyone see a source which could support this concept? That dismantling a shul is not problematic. A, because you won't have a place to daven, or B, you won't have a shul to daven. It's problematic on its own, because you are decreasing the amount of shuls and the pain that it causes you. And let's see, Jacob, Yishalmi, right? Let's listen to the Yishalmi. We've got accustomed to looking at Yishalmis and seeing ideas we didn't see in Bavli. So if you look at the Yishalmi I gave, the Yishalmi is in Megillah. Third parak of Megillah talks about Bate Knesses. She'elon l'Rav Imi. We ask Rav Imi. It sounds like Rav Ami. Ma'u likach avanim mi beis haknesses zu v'livnos mi beis haknesses acharas. Amar lon aser. Amar Rabbi Chelbo, so Rabbi Chelbo came and explained, lo aser Rav Imi, alam ipnei agmas nefesh. That's a new phrase. In Bavli we have tzluye. In Bavli we have pishiyusa. Here we have agmas nefesh. So it's a little bit different than how I'm describing it. I'm describing reverence. He's describing psychological pain. Agmas Nefesh will make us sad to say goodbye to the shul. But it's the same concept, that my relationship to a shul transcends tefillah facilitation. Sure, shul is not just in order to make sure we daven properly, because there's a better Beit Knesses down the block. It's to create a landscape dotted with Batei Knesses and Batei Midrashos, and to create that reality. Now we're diminishing it. You can't diminish the number, the identity, every shul. So I told you, this is not a Gemara that's going to all of a sudden open up right now brave new pathways in understanding the definition of a shul, but all of a sudden it changes, or at least sets, how we view a shul. There are three different views of shul being stated in the Gemara. One is a place to daven, one is a shul to daven in, which is not just a place to daven, and one is just a shul, even if you don't daven in. I have plenty of places to daven, but according to at least among the Yama Pshiusa, I can't reduce the amount of shuls in town. So I can't dismantle shul X until I rebuild shul X prime, or X, you know, X, the new X. Benji.
But just sending on the obvious question, but what is defined as being the same shul? There's a shul in Cheshmonaim that was built,
A lot of Cheshmonaim, Ariel, and all of a sudden that's it. Yeah.
So I don't remember like what it's called. There was like a shul in Brooklyn that like didn't really have a kal anymore. So
didn't really have
a kal anymore. So I think basically they made an agreement where they sold the shul in Brooklyn and used those funds to build the shul in Cheshmonaim, and they took like the yard sale board and like they keep that running in that shul there. So is that like, would that be considered the same shul or?
Yeah, but again, you're not dismantling. You're just selling the shul and doing something with the money. So the issue is to dismantle and not to stop davening there.
Even like selling it to right.
Guys, any guy can walk into Gush and see what's on the front of Gush? Any read those strange letters? Sam Stein, Kehillas, Newark, New Jersey. This yeshiva was built in the 70s, largely based on monies donated by the Jewish community of Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey, anyone know their history? Late 60s, there were racial riots, tire burnings, protests, people thrown in jail. There's all these racial riots in Detroit, in Chicago, Newark, New Jersey, inner city riots. So over the next 5-6 years after those riots, Jews started moving out of Newark. And around the early 70s, the Newark community decided they just couldn't continue, so they sold off all their Sefer Torah, their shul, and they had a big board meeting what to do with their leftover money. And it was two choices on the docket. One was to give it to, I think, Emunah Women, and one was to give it to a small yeshiva operating out of an old army barrack in Kfar Etzion named Yeshiva Har Etzion to help them build their new campus. What do you think they decided? How do I know how they decide? It's actually a cute story. About 22 years ago, literally a long, 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 long time ago, I was in the base medicine, and some kid comes walking into Gush, literally. I mean, he looked like this, I promise you. Where's Rabbi Tarek? I say, oh, he's over there. Not Rabbi Tarek. Finally comes to me and wants to transfer to the yeshiva. Okay, so I put him through the ranks. Like, what do you want to transfer? I'm waiting for him to say, because the shiurim is so great, because the Rosh Yeshiva, because the director of admissions is so handsome. I don't know. 100,000 director of admissions then. 100 different. Why does he want to transfer to yeshiva? He has asthma. And he needs to be in the mountains. And wherever yeshiva is, it's closer to the coast and it's too hot for him. He needs to be in the mountains. This is yeshiva in the mountains. I said, I heard a lot of reasons to transfer to Gush in my life. This is the first. You want to be a mountain man. You want to drive your 4x4. Okay, so I put him through. He really didn't belong in yeshiva. So I rejected him. And I started getting calls, faxes. I got no emails. Not one. There weren't emails. Faxes and calls. That's how long ago it was. Faxes, calls. I've gotten calls. I've gotten letters from Supreme Court judges, which, like, in the pressure rankings are pretty low. Like, yeah, you really know the kid, right? Because the kid's father is a major donor to your political party, so you threw a letter together. Like, that's not going to press. I'd rather hear from the high school principal. Quite honest, I'd rather hear from the high school gym teacher. You know, he's the guy to tell me about the kid. That's a Supreme Court judge who writes some form letter because the father called it a favor. Okay, we rejected him. Then I get a letter from the rabbi of the next town over in New Jersey. He says, oh, this boy's grandmother was part of that Newark Jewish community, and she cast the deciding vote in favor of Yeshiva Har Etzion. that all the money of the newer community should go to Yeshivat Har Etzion. So maybe this boy should be granted acceptance to your institution. So I was young. I said, well, what do I care? Money, shmoney, what grandparents are. I brought it to Rav Aaron, and Rav Aaron said, of course we have to accept him. Loyalty. And Rav Aaron was a very loyal person. One of the traits he taught me was loyalty. Loyalty to the grandmother. And this kid was really, really far from yeshiva. I accepted him to yeshiva. Came 3 years, served in the army. His brother came 3 years, served in the army. Like, it was a total turnaround. So Benji, it's not just some... Actually, there actually is a shul in Brooklyn that was sold about 10 years ago that monies were donated to Gush. So when you're eating your schnitzel, you're really eating that shul in Brooklyn's membership dues. Alex?
If the reason behind destroying the shul is not because of davening, but because of
Shuls.
So then why can we, even once the new shul is built, why
could you destroy them? Right, so as we're talking about Joe, evidently there's a gross number of shuls. We can't have shuls lasting forever, so you have to at least maintain our batting average, our amount of shuls. Once we build a new one, then we've got our 10, then we can dismantle the 11th. Okay? Now, let's just spend a minute before we go into the real lumdus, or at least introduce the real lumdus. Maremar and Marzutra would build shuls and alternate, take down summer shuls, rebuild winter shuls. First of all, who is Maremar? Anyone know when he lived, who he was, when? Okay, Maremar was one of that last generation of Amoraim. His friends were, interestingly enough, Marzutra. His other friends were Rav Ashi and Ravina. So Maremar was that last, we know Ravina and Rav Ashi, but Maremar, Marzutra, Mar Bar Rav Ashi was Rav Ashi's son. So he gets counted along that last little... In Hebrew, it's called Nagla, that last little group of, last group of Amorayim. Maremo's Rebbe, just to help you place him, was Rav Papi, we'll talk about Rav Papa, just to give you, we're starting to get a little bit of a sense of Rav, Rav Huna, Rav Chizda, Rav Papa, Maremo Marzutra, just to be able to follow. This is like a spine. This is the spine. And okay, who was during Rav Papa's time? Who was during, I'm sorry, I skipped Rav. Who was during Rav, during the Bayit? I'll just give you a sense of how that Masara unfolded, those five or six generations of Amorayim. Okay, so Maremar and Marzutra would rebuild in the... How did they rebuild? I mean, why didn't they worry about Pshiusa? So who asked this question? Anyone see this question? I just want to make sure you cover the... Who asked this question? The Rosh Ben Tosfos. So let's see what Tosfos says. Tosfos gives basically three or four answers. Okay, the easiest answer is that Maremar and Marzutra Paskin, like the Amandi Amar, Tzuyi. And there were two shuls, a summer and a winter shul. There's no problem of Pshiusa. But the Gemara doesn't say that. So it sounds like Maremar and Marzutra are free agents. They could hold Pshiusa also. So if they hold Pshiusa, how could they take down a shul? How could they rebuild the summer shul before they rebuilt the summer shul and then took down the old summer shul? So Tosfos asks the question, Hagah, Be kayata or be situya, habi kimo ika tiyuei. The first answer Tosfos says, which is a big of a chiddush, is that just like you're allowed to dismantle a shul for structural concerns, you're allowed to dismantle it for inclement, unsuitable weather conditions. And that would be a tremendous heter. That basically any time we want to improve a shul, unless we just want to add, I don't know, a golden candelabra, but any time we want to, oh, this shul is too hot, this shul is too cold, this shul is too small, this shul is too big, this shul is too old, this shul... Okay, demolish it and rebuild it. That would be a tremendous shift in halachic psak, this tells us. If you're looking for a kula, you found it. We thought tiyua means, oh, the shul's about to fall apart, the engineers are coming and saying it's dangerous, of course take it down. Now tells us, saying, no, inclement, it's uncomfortable, take it down. Tremendous chiddush. That's why tells us isn't happy with the chiddush, so he has to give other approaches. The od nira, skipping a few lines, kivan yesham beis haknesses achar ein lachosh, tells us paskins like the regular girsa, that if there's another shul, then either on the Amar Pshiusa would let you build. The only machlokus is if there's no shul, it's just the place. And it's talking about where there was that they had the winter beis haknesses to fall back on. So even though they were rebuilding, demolishing the summer beis haknesses till they rebuilt it better over the winter, they always had their winter beis haknesses. There was another option, and here it tells us paskins like that other option. Yeah, sorry.
What if you need to do what if you want to do renovations on the davening part of the shul and you want to make davening?
Right, so this is where you ask a posek, and the posek starts with this gemara and then follows through the shulchan aruch, and right, that's what you're starting to learn is the machinery of psak. We start with Gemaras and we move on to Rishon and then move on to Poskim, and right, that's why to be very, 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 very careful about, is it usser, just by way of example, I'm just picking this out of a hat because it's election day, is it usser to give back land for peace? I mean, silly, because no one really wants to make peace with us. But let's say in theory, the entire Arab world would line up and say, let's make peace, and we were convinced of their sincerity, let's say, which I'm not, I don't think any reasonable-minded person is, but let's say they were. So you can say it's not a good idea, militarily, strategically, diplomatically, ideologically, historically, culturally, scripturally, any word you want. But you can't use the following word. You can't use the word aser. Because there's no sources. There's no Shulchan Aruch. There's no Gemara. Why? Because it wasn't ever an issue, right? The Shulchan Aruch didn't write about giving back land in Israel. The Gemara didn't write about giving back land in Israel. So the only thing you're going to pasken on is your interpretation of a pasuk in Devarim. We don't make psak based on pasukim. We make psak based on a whole litany of sources. This is integrity of psak. Start with the Gemara, you go to a Rishon, you go to an Achron. Okay? Another example. These are really important messages, guys. I'm sorry it's in the middle of a Gemara Seder, but okay. A woman can have an aliyah. Let's say a shul decides they're going to give aliyahs to women. So it depends upon, I don't believe you should, I don't think you should, I wouldn't doubt in a shul that does, but listen carefully, because the language is important. If they say, oh, Chazal said you shouldn't give an aliyah to a woman, but Chazal, they were old fogies living in caves who didn't understand how the world worked, and they thought the world was flat. We don't care about those Chazal. We're in a modern, enlightened world, and I won't say it's kfira, but it's close to it, and it's certainly not orthodox thought, certainly not halachic integrity. It's you don't get near that person. I mean, you get near that person, but he's a Jew, and she's a Jew. But let's say a shul wants to give an aliyah to a woman and says, well, I know Chazal said no, but based on my diak in a ritva, my diak in a rashba, my diak in a shach, my diak in a sma, and you say, that's crazy. That's the way you read the sma. You're pushing it. My hammies are snapping. That's not really what they're saying. Most Gedolim and Poskim don't agree with you. I still don't agree with Epsak, but at least they are operating within the rubric of Chazal. And, you know, again, at a certain point, if you're just, you know, falsifying facts, not only the rubric, at least there's halachic fidelity. At least, okay, let's see what the sources say. You make a psak, you don't just say, what do you think? You go through and you start with the sugya, and you go through what the Rashba says, what the Ritva says, what the Rambam says, what the Torah says, what the Yazir says, and you can pick out different shittot. Okay, it's really important that you understand how halacha reaches a psak, and that's why this is a good sugya, right? Because we're often posking about building walls of marble between two shchenim, but we always posking about refurbishing and remodeling, and the sugya starts here, but it doesn't end here. And that's why I can't give you an answer, because we'd have to spend weeks and weeks and weeks parsing all the information and then seeing what modern-day poskim have said. Okay? What's the third answer of Tosfos? What's the third answer of Tosfos? Machmas kar v'chom ein lachosh. Even if we poskim pshiusa, no one's going to be derelict or negligent about it. When it's cold outside, people are building. They're living in Bavel, they didn't have indoor heating. No one's going to be davening on the street. When it's hot or cold, when it comes to other factors, let's say we just want to take down a shul and we have plenty of comfortable shuls, but it's not because of size and whether they have enough room for the Kiddush Club, people will be derelict. But when they're freezing, they're going to put together the resources and build. So there's no worry about shoes. So those pressures, those triggers will create diligence and efficiency. What's the final answer of Tosfos? We don't have to worry about shoes, according to Maraimar. Not just because it's hot and cold, not just because of another shul, not just because the hot and cold creates a TUO-like reality where it's structurally flawed. What's the final answer tells us? The ode, machmas kar v'chom, ein lachosh shema yifshu. Oh, the final answer, bizman gadol kol kach ein lachosh. Since they have such a long time to build, they have a full 6 months. Remember, their buildings didn't take long. It took a couple of weeks. Since we have 6 months until we'll need the shul for the summer, because we're starting to build it, you know, November 1st, and we have 6 months till, 7 months till June 1st, so we don't have to worry that the shul won't get built. By the way, this Pshat and Tosfos Paskins against whom? Who does this Pshat and Tosfos disagree with? The Rashba, right? The Rashba says we're not concerned with long-term negligence, we're concerned with what's going to happen during those 6 months when they don't have the shul. So this Tosfos, this last Pshat and Tosfos disagrees with the Rashba. They just suggest ways of Tosfos to transform Mar Zutra and Meraimar even according to the Amar Pshirusa, even though they didn't have another Beis HaKnesses because it was cold and because... Okay, let's stop this conversation here and let's introduce the Lamdish part of the Sukkah. To help introduce that, let's read the Sifra. Everyone take out your sheet, please. We'll start with the Sifra. I'll just introduce two or three halachos. You'll see them again, Mr. Shem, in preparation. And now we're going to talk about the role and the status of the Beis Knesses, Me'ikra D'dina. Not the prohibition of dismantling, which is only a technical concern, but what Kedusha does the Beis Knesses have? Sifra, Parshas Bichlukosai, V'hishmadati es Migdashechem. Shem says, I will destroy your Migdashechem. How many Mikdashim is Hashem going to promise to destroy? Mikdash, Mikdashi, Mikdashechem. That word Mikdashechem is almost as if it has three. It doesn't say Hashem also says Mikdash. It's Mikdashechem. Mikdash, it's on your source sheets. Anyone not have the source sheets? I have extra ones. I brought it to the sheet. Anyone not have it? I'm going to give one to Roni. Okay. It's part six, the Sifra. Okay. Vashimosi is Mikdashechem. Mikdash, Mikdashi, Mikdashechem. Lerabos, Bate Knesios, Uvate Midrashos. Shem says that in some cases your punishment will be that your local shuls will be emptied. This Sifra makes it sound like a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMedrash without distinguishing right now has a status of Beis HaMikdash. Torah says Mikdashi, and the Sifra says Larabos, Bate Knesios, and Bate Midrashos. Is this just a reference or a metaphor, or does this have real halachic connotations? So today we'll see some Rishonim who felt there are real halachic connotations, some of which are just theoretical, some of which are actual. Okay? The Gemara in Megillah, on Daf Chavtes, says, based on a pasuk in, let's read the Gemara, pasuk in Yechezkel, which the Kodesh Baruch Hu promises us, that even though we'll go to Babel, Hashem says, Vo'ehi lohem mikdash miat. That I will be for you a mikdash me'at. That's a phrase you've heard before. So the literal translation of the pasuk in Yechezkel is, don't worry, you don't have a Beis HaMikdash, but I'll be with you. I'll be your Beis HaMikdash. But why does Hashem say mikdash me'at? He should have said, v'ei lehem mikdash. Why does Yechezkel write mikdash me'at? So the Gemara in Megillah claims, chav tesem and beis, sorry, Chavtesim and Aleph. Ve'elem lemikdash miat amar Rabbi Yitzchak elu bate knesios vate midrasha shebibavel. So it's not just the pasuk in Bichul Kosai that the Sifra interprets to refer to Beis HaKnesses and Beis HaMedrash, but it's a Cheskel's pasuk. Ve'ehi vav aleph hey yud ve'ehi lohem mikdash miat. Again, is this just a phrase, a promise, a consolation, or does a Beis HaKnesses have a status of a Beis HaMikdash? So this all starts with the Tosefta. Again, I spent a lot of time this morning trying to print this out, and fortunately the office was closed, so please take a look at the page I sent you on your WhatsApp, okay? Please, we'll read it together. The Tosefta in Megillah. Bate Kinesios. Okay, this speaks a little bit to what we said last night. A little bit to what I mentioned this morning, right? I'll just give you a spoiler. I have five tips for davening, and none of them are kavana. Five things kavana I can't control, five things I can't control. And in my mind, if you work on those five things that are easy to control, then you'll have a successful tefillah, even if you don't have a spit of kavana. And one of them is to conduct yourself with respect and reverence in the shul. Certainly during davening, to know you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, you know, guys know, whoever has seen the new shul, and you know, you have like these little movie chair seats, and you like sit on the seats like this, and shake and bend. And my kids know that when they're davening, they always stand upright. No leaning, no hunching over, no sitting backwards, no. Stand upright, sit upright, standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Tosefta says, Bate Knisios, Ein Nalagim Bahem Kalis Rosh. You can't just be lightheaded in shul. Lo Yikanes Bahem Bacham Mechama, you shouldn't use this for shelter, obviously, just to shield yourself. Ein Ochlim Bahem, you shouldn't eat in shul. Again, this is talking about a basic Knesset. Ein Shosin Bahem, Ein Yishenim Bahem, we'll talk about this. Can you sleep in shul? Any of you ever see someone sleeping in shul in Yom Kippur? That's totally no longer. My memories of Yom Kippur as a kid, people would bring their pillow to shul and sleep in shul overnight in Yom Kippur. That was an old European custom, sleep at shul, not Yom Kippur. None of you ever seen it? For me, it was like part of Yom Kippur. Old men would bring their pillows, sleep in shul. Okay, but shouldn't sleep in general. Okay, Amar of Yehuda. Okay, that's just the Tosefta. If you take a look a little bit, take a look back on your sheet. So this is quoted by the Uraim. Okay, say if the Uraim back on the sheet, I printed it out for you. Since we're talking about Masara today, who is the Uraim? Anyone know his name, his placement, where he lived? Okay, Sefer Uraim is one of the Sefer HaMitzvos. It was written by someone named Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz. Metz is a Franco-German town along the border. He lived in the end of the 12th century, so about a generation after the Rambam. Okay, if you're looking, his Rebbe was Rabbeinu Tam. His Talmud was the Rav Yah. And many other Rabbeim. Talmud, this is the most prominent Talmud. So if you want to know how we get from Rashi to the Torah, Rashi lives in the early part of the 11th century. The Torah lives in the 14th century, about 300 years of Ashkenazic Masara. Rashi taught his grandson Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam taught his Talmud Eliezer of Metz, Uraim. Eliezer of Metz taught Eliezer Bar Yoel, the Rav Yah. The Rav Yah taught the Or Zeruah, Yitzchak of Vienna. Yitzchak of Vienna taught the Maharami Rotenberg of France. The Maharami Rotenberg taught the Rush, and the Rush was the father of the Torah. That's how you get from 1070 in France, Rashi, to 1340, the Torah, Bala Torah. Okay? Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, Uraim, Rav Yah, Or Zeruah, Marami Rotenberg, Rush Tor. Okay, so the Uraim, Rabbeinu Eliezer of Metz, says, V'yereisa me'elokecha, the pasuk of Mara Mikdash, the mitzvah of Mara Mikdash, tziva b'hikanis adam l'mikdash, obe beis ha-kneses, obe beis ha-medrash, she'yinhag bohem mara v'kibud. You should honor and respect, I'm skipping to the next page, u'matzinu beis ha-kneses, u'beis ha-medrash, Shenikru Mikdash, the Tanya Bataras Kohanim, Bahashi Moses Mikdashechem, Mikdash, Mikdashi, Mikdashechem. He quotes the Sifra, and of course he quotes the Din of Mara. If you look at the Smak, we already saw the Smak, we've got Yitzchak of Kurbil, Mitzvah Vav, Uvizman Azeb, Beis HaKnesses, Mikdash Mi'at. Skipping to line number 4 from the bottom, where he talks about this Tosefta, the Asar Lino Behem Kalos Rosh. You shouldn't be lightheaded, you shouldn't be irreverent. Levad Sudas Mitzvah. You can have a Sudas Mitzvah. So one application is, you shouldn't have Kalas Rosh, you shouldn't behave in a shul, the same way you have to be careful about your behavior in the Beis HaMikdash. Second application in the Tosefta. There are three applications today. Halachic applications. Fascinating question. Take a look at the Tosefta number 2 on your WhatsApp. Okay. Okay, this is Perek Gimel Lachach. Okay. Halacha Chaf Gimel. Perek Gimel Lachach Gimel, the second part of 2. Ein Boninosa Ela Begova Shebeir. Very sad. Ideally, a Beis HaKnesses has to be built in the highest place in the city. There should be no buildings in the city higher than the Beis HaKnesses. What's the pasuk in Mishlei? Birosh Hamiyos Tikra. Now, why is this sad? Anyone? Right, because throughout the last hundreds of years in Europe, first of all, the churches had to be the tallest building. Literally, you can go through Europe. Okay, and in Europe, in many cities, depends on modern building, not in Paris, obviously, but in many, many cities, in Vienna, Budapest, Bokera. Many of these Central European towns where there hasn't been mass skyscrapers, the tallest building is always the old Revere Church. And even when they build these beautiful parliaments in the late 19th century, the rules were the parliament couldn't be any larger, any taller than the. And part of that was that shuls not just couldn't tower above churches, but they had to be hovels. Like there's strict, strict requirements on what types of shuls you could build. I mean, has anyone ever visited the Altenai Shul? Anyone in Prague? Altenai?
Where is it?
In Prague. Maral Shul. The Golem Shul. Fake Golem Shul. So, you guys know the Golem didn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. It's a children's story.
Rosenberg.
What?
It's Rosenberg.
Right, okay. In Montreal, good Canada, right? You didn't want to expose it. Okay, anyway, so the Altenai Shul is the most revered shul in Europe, and you walk into it, it's disgusting. I mean, it's not disgusting because I love it because it's a shul, but structurally, architecturally, it's a hovel. It's damp, it's mildewy, it's dark, it's under the ground. So can you imagine every day of your life, think about it, the next time you walk into the Kush Beis Medrash, and you're living in a palace of Torah with marble, and you're living with beautiful waterfalls and beautiful rolling flowers and trees. Imagine your ancestors walking through these little hovels, these little corners, because that was part of the psychological persecution of the Jews. That we're going to Sunday Mass in our finest clothing, into our steeples and our cathedrals, and yesterday you walk into your little tin can, little huts that you can. Okay, so that's why it's a little sad. But this comes from the Beis HaMikdash being Benk Tefav Shechein, the Beis HaMikdash is on higher ground. Benji.
There's a shul down
the
block from my house,
which is
across the...
Benji lives in a really shul area. I like this. Okay, I want to visit the Wieners.
It's across the street from a church. So apparently, I guess the church was the capital of the cross was at like the maximum height allowed by zoning laws. So when... It's like a city shul. So when the Rav built it, he actually like had the workers build the top of the building slightly higher than the... for the first while that... I don't know how long, but the Ezer's Nashim was off limits until finally...
He came and he put a little bobby pin on top of the mucking top. It should be officially 1 centimeter higher than the chair. They reached the side. Like, just be fair. Put a bobby pin on top. Put a little checker for you. Cute. Okay. So the Rambam quotes this. Let's read the Rambam. He quotes this halacha. The Rambam, source number 4. Kishe bonim beis haknesses. Ein bonin osa ele begova shel ir. The highest place of the city. And you raise the shul. Ajite gava mikol chatzero seir. Shenemar quotes a pasuk in Ezra about the Beis HaMikdash. Well, the Rambam is based on Elokeinu. The pasuk can be found in source number 3. Okay, so the Rambam quotes the height issue. It's the second application. Number 1, Shenev Kalas Rosh. Number 2, it has to be the tallest building. Number 3, third application, before I get to the fourth, which is fascinating, but it's not already in the Rambam, it's already in Achronim. Can you use the roof of a shul? I know we can't use the shul itself for eating, drinking, sleeping. We can use the roof of a shul. Anyone know the shul called Hechel Shlomo in Yerushalayim, right across from the hotels there? One of the old, where the Rabbanut HaRashit used to be. There's a famous, right near the Beit HaKnesses HaGadol, this big building. Gersh owns it. We officially own it. If you go up to the roof there, it's a roof, a beautiful, beautiful view of the entire Yerushalayim. We'll take you up there at some point for like kumzitz or something. So I can use the roof of a shul. Why not? It's not the shul. So the Mordechai says, source number 5, the Mordechai in Shabbos, Kasev Rabbeinu Meir, he's quoting Marami Rottenberg, line number 2, Eini yodea isur gamur l'shtamish bi'aliyah, shagat beis haknesses. The roof or a loft maybe, not just the roof, but the loft of a shul, the upper stories of a shul. Miu, Yeshli, line 3 from the bottom, just reading this very quickly with you, Veshema, 3 lines from the bottom, Dami, Lealios Hechel, Sheniskatshu, the Mikdash Meat Shalanu, Yeshlin Gabo Kadisha Ktsats, Mein Kadisha Hechel. In the base of Mikdash, all these upper offices and lofts, you know how the Chatzim in the base of Mikdash was built, it was surrounded by a promenade and surrounded by offices and lishkaos and aliyos and rooms, almost like a coliseum, and those had kedusha. So, in the Beis HaMikdash, structurally, architecturally, these little side rooms that were built on the upper stories had kedusha. Then maybe these little upper stories of a shul should have kedusha. So you can't live in the upper story of a shul. It's an interesting question in Ashkenaz. Can you live in the upper story of a shul? Maybe it's like a Beis HaMikdash. Fourth application. Take a look at the Bir Halacha. This is already not in Rishonim. But this is, to me, the most fascinating. Is there a mitzvah to build a shul? As there is a mitzvah to build, obviously it's important, it's a mitzvah, but is there a tariag mitzvah? Are you chayav to build a shul? Now, of course, Rabbi Tarragon, what difference does it make if we have a formal mitzvah or not? We're all building shuls, like what's the big difference? Here's the interesting question. If you have a mitzvah, then you have to do it. Okay, I don't know how to build. I'm not an architect. I'm not an engineer. What are you making me do? Okay, make a shliach. Who can't be a shliach? A guy. Can you build a shul with a guy? Now today, that's a really practical question. How many Jews are you going to find in construction? Like the graduating class of Frisch from 2019. How many of you guys are going to go into construction? Not too many, right? Be lawyers, doctors, engineers, Indian chiefs, but not too many people in construction, right? But throughout Europe, those were big questions for many reasons. First of all, legal ordinances had it that you had to hire the king's architect or designer. Second of all, there was a status symbol as Jews started to break out of the ghetto. They wanted to have beautiful shuls that were designed by the top architects in Europe and constructed by the art. Even if we could build the actual shul, the artwork. If you go through shuls in Europe, you'll see a lot of art that's very non-Jewish. And the artists tried really hard, but they didn't know they weren't Jews. I know all sorts of Adam and Eve scenes that just really aren't true. Monsters that don't exist in Tanakh, sea fish. They were really trying. I mean, they were pulling based on their Christian imagery that they know. They weren't doing it to sabotage the shul. They said, please, build a nice shul. And how much could you teach a guy? The Geish artist, you see these images. Wait a second, where does that come from? That's not a Medrash. That's not Adam and Chava. That's something really different. Who is that strange three-headed monster that comes from Greek mythology or that comes from Zeus and Apollo? They did their best, and they just assumed. So the Vir Halacha, Chavetz Chaim wants to know. I am Bercha Yosef, the Kasav. The Yeshmi Shekasav, the Ein Livnos Beis HaKnesses, Ayide Goy. Or Befrat La Selz Kimin Kippa, Lefnei Hecha Lenoi. Bevada, so here he talks about what we talked about last night. Even if you do hire a guy, he shouldn't build it looking like a church. To build this little dome in front of the shul, does it look beautiful? Well, you know what? Sometimes it works, sometimes it didn't. Dafka Jews who were trying to emancipate themselves and secularize, they started to build shuls that looked like churches. And if you go through a lot of the shuls in Europe, some of the most fancy shuls look a lot like churches. What does it mean to look like churches? Well, what's the major issue that makes a shul look like a church?
Architecture.
What?
Architecture.
Right, okay, but halachically. What's one thing that will really mock it? What? Oh, well, no one put a cross in
shul. There's like an issue with Gothic architecture.
Yeah, okay, maybe yes, maybe not. It's very abstract. But what real material part of a shul has to be, I'll give you a hint, placed in a certain location that it shouldn't look like a church? The bima. That's why the bima is not in the front. As in churches, the altar, podium, bima, sacrament, not really known churches well, but everything's taking place in front. Yeah, that's why today people are so mocked not to have the bima in front. So you have a little shtender, like why do we make this all big deal? Shtender, bima, kabbalah, Shabbos, Meir, you go here, you go there. Have it all in front, get up there, it's not a big deal. And it's just we don't like having our bima up front. You'll go to many shuls in Europe, and aside from the Gothic architecture, and aside from the organ pipes, aside from the things that may or may, and these are very abstract, right? It's to have an organ pipe, it just reminds us of. But in halacha, you'll have the bima should not be up front because that is church-like, and therefore the bima's in the middle. Okay, so sometimes you daven up front, so there's a little shtender there for the chaz and the gav front, but we daven from the middle of the shul. That's why the bima in the middle of the shul is a big issue. Yes, you know.
Is it like a halachic problem, or is it a marzayin or a...
No, it's chuk m'sayim basil. At the very least, it's chuk m'sayim basil lechu. As we'll see, you can compromise Kedushas Mikdash by creating it in a way that doesn't resemble the Beis HaMikdash. So we're going to start here. We're going to see, of course, the Rambam. What other halachas like Beis HaMikdash does a shul have? And then we'll see the Ramban who says, nah, it's not a Beis HaMikdash. So it's not a Beis HaMikdash. Where do all these halachas come from? Why can't you have Kalas Rosh? Why does the Kedusha come from? Two different versions of where the Kedusha of Yeshua comes from. The Rambam is going all in on this approach. So it's Kedusha like a Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam says, nah, that's not that. Let's see what comes in. Alex.
Just to clarify, the part about the Bima, that's what the Bir Halacha was talking about?
No, the Bir Halacha is talking about a kippah. You shouldn't have a dome like a... It looks very much like all these churches are built with these basilicas and domes. Okay? We will stop here. Shir Kali today. Again, Rav Moshe is giving a shir. It's nice when reality and Lumbus overlap. We're literally right out that discussion of Hordas, King Herodian. You're going to Herodian tomorrow. So, Halacha, Lumbus, and Tiulim, right? The Triple Crown. So, Herodian, or Herod, was a very, very, Hordas was a very, very, let's say, controversial figure. What do Chazal think about him? I would say maybe, just a good idea, just wiki Herod before you start, just to know who you're talking about, just to know, what Chazal said. If you don't know who Hordas was, like, just general stuff, like who was he, when did he live, what did people say, at least you know, what... Reading on the top, right? But read the Gemara, but also just to know like who he is, not just what Chazal was saying about like you're not going to get when he lived and what his relationship with the Romans were, and just take a minute and just put it into context, and then of course read the Gemara and enjoy the shiur. Okay, as they say in Chicago, vote early and often.